Okay, hypothetical.
Yep.
Purely hypothetical. You're walking your dogs, you know,
okay,
Peter cool. Jr. and Vlad, and you realize you're halfway through, you're on the little trail down by the river or wherever you go, and one of them goes to the bat, like, poops, and you realize you don't have any bags with you, and you kind of pooped on the side of the trail.
Yep.
What do you do? What's the right thing to do, and what do? No one's around.
I think the right thing to do is search for a bag of some sort.
Try to get a bag.
And then vow to yourself never to let this happen again.
Take a bag with you.
Well, just say, like, from now on, I've made a mistake. I feel bad. But from now on, I will remember a bag of some sort. But
do you leave it there? Do you try to find a stick and at least get it off the trail?
Ooh, that's a good option. I would say I would walk for as much as like 5 minutes in either direction to find, because where we live, they have, like, I think most places have this, they have like little bag stations where you can
get
a portable bag. If you forgot, I would search for one of those. Now, if my time allotment has expired, I think I might do the stick method. It would also depend on how many people were around. If it was pretty busy and I come back to the scene of the quote unquote crime and my two dogs are kind of wondering why we're back here, and I grab a stick and I fling it into a bush, and you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary are walking by.
Get some weird looks.
Yeah, like, hey, weird looks. And that section of the trail is no longer one we can walk on, because yeah. posters will be up. And you know, it might be a crime. Is it a crime?
They have at the city park that I walk to sometimes, there are signs that said it's a city and county ordinance that you clean up after your dog and everything.
I got another question for you. It just popped in my head. Yeah, it's funny you bring up those signs. It's often, I've seen them, of a dog squatting and pooping. How many people do you think have to clear that sign before it gets sent out to communities? Because I feel like it's one company makes these signs, and then,
like, on the city council, they got to approve.
It various cities come to this company and say, hey, we need some signs for our parks.
Yeah.
What do you got? And they go, well,
what you, I'm imagining an earlier draft
where you looking
maybe
for?
Has some poop coming out, and they're like, whoa, whoa, whoa,
whoa,
like,
whoa, that's whoa. Not,
we don't need to be that graphic. I think just the squatting. And then they come back, the ad company comes back, and it's just a dog standing, and the city council's like, well, I didn't want to discourage you. You got to show something of him being in the act, so you got to go back and forth. I imagine it was some wrangling, and they finally
just it up. A dog laying down is like with a circle with an X through it, and be like, what is this?
No droplet.
No dead dogs.
But he's just squatting. I think we get the idea. Yeah.
I've seen ones that go so far as no peeing on like bushes.
There's only so much you can do.
There's only so much you can control.
As a dog, or an owner of a dog who pees on all sorts of things 10 times during a 20-minute walk, there's nothing. Why?
Yeah, what do you do? You drag it off?
You want me to, like, give me a paper towel?
And does it actually do damage? That's the question I have.
I don't think so.
And if it does, like,
I try to keep them out of people's gardens and stuff, like private people's yards, but private. I don't know. Like, the in a city park or something, there's only so much you can do.
I walk fast.
I'm kind of curious. I want to say again, because those signs make me a little nervous. So this is purely hypothetical.
Hypothetical, of course.
I may or may not have done the stick method.
Oh, okay.
Oh, crap. Well, and then maybe. Hypothetically, or I always have a bag because I'm responsible.
I think that was a pun. Yeah, you're responsible. Yeah. I mean,
You can't
look at you without saying, boy, that guy's responsible. Hypothetically speaking, stick, where are we looking for it? Are we breaking it off a tree?
Hypothetically, I was able to just find a stick.
Just find a stick.
I didn't have to go that
far. I think it'd be funny if the story was, you snap a branch. In my head, hypothetically speaking, best story would be it's a yard, it's someone's yard. They have a nice tree there. You break off a branch off of their tree. That's also damage. That's also a crime. You take the stick, you fling it in, you look up, they're watching you the whole time. And then, it's bad news.
You know what bugs me though? Like a pet peeve of mine? A lot of people do it around here.
A lot of puns today.
They have the bags. Pet peeve. That's the episode title.
It's pet peeve. No, it's not. But
pet peeves.
Pet peeves?
Pet peeves. Sounds like a kid's book. Anyway, I hate it when people actually bag up the poop, but then leave it sitting.
Yeah, what's the deal there?
That is the opposite of what needs to happen. Dog poop is biodegradable, but it's correctly considered, it's the right thing to do because you don't want to be walking around just constantly stepping in it. If everybody just let their dog go wherever, it would be chaos. And there's a reason the norms and the rules about dog dropping are in place for a reason. I'm on board with them.
I agree.
You should bag them up and get them out of the way so you're not just stepping it everywhere. That's no fun. But if you just bag it up and leave it by the side of the road, you just made it worse. It would be better, because now you're leaving a bag that's not going to degrade. You're just sitting there. It's just sitting in the middle of the trail, middle of the sidewalk. That's even worse.
I got another hypothetical, and I might get in trouble for this one. Okay.
That's why it's hypothetical.
It's a hypothetical, but it's not me who does this, so it's my significant other. Hypothetically speaking, let's say you're on a hike and you go out and back, and hypothetically one of your dogs poops pretty early on in the hike.
Okay.
Is it okay to bag it, leave it right there with the intention when you come back in an hour, you will pick it up and then walk the next 5 minutes and throw it away?
I think so.
Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah, because it's bad, no one's gonna step in it, and as long as you're not just leaving it there.
It looks like it was just left there.
Well, that doesn't matter.
Should we leave a note that says
we'll be back?
We'll be back in 1 hour. Actually, don't touch.
Tell her I said bring some sticky pads with you. And
hypothetically, what has also happened is we've created a trend. So where there was one bag, when we come back, there are three bags, and we don't know which one is ours.
Oh, it's like a leprechaun trick.
So you have to. It's kind of like a white elephant gift, or what's that gift thing where you pick a gift and you're not sure what it is, but you're not going to open it.
No, you're not going to open it. And the noble thing to do would be just to take all three.
That's a little. Do you think your dog knows?
I leave a note and it'd say dog poop, do not eat. So people know.
You meet someone on the trails and they see your little notebook there. And they're like, oh, are you recording like what birds you see and all the new trees you're identifying? No, this is just my poop identifier notebook.
I label dog poop so nobody eats it.
Anyway. I think these are all good hypotheticals.
Hypothetically. Just something I've been noticing. Because you're better off bagging it up and leave it there. You're better off taking the dog off trail and letting it go. You're not leaving a bag in the middle of nature.
Yeah, it's true. If it goes off trail and goes and you don't see it.
Is that okay? I mean, if you're off in the mountains.
It's kind of like if a tree falls in the forest type thing.
Yeah. Yeah. If anyone from the city is listening, we are very responsible.
We're responsible.
But you know what else I was thinking of after the hypothetical scenario today?
Yep.
You know who nobody gives a crap about? Horses.
Yeah, there's really. Horses
through town, they poop right in the middle of the sidewalk and it's just considered okay. And your dog starts to eat the poop. And you gotta.
Hypothetically speaking.
Yeah.
It's That's why they got rid of horses.
Who cares about that? Horses just, I'm fine with horses and stuff. But they just, you know, walking down the road, they poop right in the middle, and we just, you know, there's no horse signs.
It's kind of romantic, isn't it? Is it? Kind of.
I mean, poop is, yeah.
Not the poop, but just like, I think the horse is, and therefore maybe the idea of the horse pooping.
That is very romantic.
I think the horse carriage is romantic, not the horse poop.
Yeah, well, these aren't carriages I'm talking about. These are people.
Where are you? The horses are just riding around.
Half a mile down the road by the Hooter River Trail.
You're giving too much information away, but yeah, you do live by.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Too much.
And there's if you go out to the foothills and hike around, there are people with horses. There's horse trailer, like parking spots just for horse trailers. It's a common thing.
I think nobody puts signs
like, hey, don't let your horse poop in the middle of the trail. Nobody cares about that.
I think if you come upon horse crap, you almost like gotta notify the government or the local authorities and be like, you're gonna need some equipment to get this horse crap out of the road. Yeah.
You get lapped away.
I guess then if it's a dog, you say, hey, you could have done that yourself. So anyway.
This has been very good intro.
Yeah, it's very long. Look at the time and it's this is good. I mean all time classic. Welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books. Hypothetically speaking, books. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Tonight's episode, we are picking a seasonal read. Our last episode, we discussed our seasonal. The reason why I'm not naming the season is because we don't follow the seasons per se. I guess you could say this is our winter seasonal.
This would be the autumn one. Hypothetically, autumn. We missed the summer one.
Hypothetically.
And Lonesome Dove was our spring one.
We did Lonesome Dove. And then before that, we did Dune.
Correct?
Dune. Yeah. So those two. And then last year, we did The Count of Monte Cristo. So we've done three seasonal books. Out of those three, I would say, for me personally, it's The Count of Monte Cristo, followed closely by Lonesome Dove. And then I didn't not like it, but Dune is third.
Yeah.
It's not really close to the other two.
It's about where I'm at. I've enjoyed all of them. I think we've picked pretty well. And hopefully we'll do it.
Hopefully we'll do it
again. I got a good lineup.
I don't, but that's typical. But before that, I have a little running series here where it's called Peter Reads Contemporary Fiction, New Fiction, and he gives his feelings, his thoughts. And I started off with Sally Rooney's new book, Beautiful World, Where Are You? Not a big fan of it. Disappointed. It ended better than it started. I'm not sure which episode I talked about that. But yeah, that was that review. And the second in this series is called Bewilderment by Richard Powers. The very highly thought of and touted Richard Powers. I read his book, previous book, The Overstory, which I believe won the Pulitzer Prize. He won
some of his won the Pulitzer,
Yeah. And he's written over a dozen books.
What's his big one? He didn't do, there's Richard Ford and there's Richard Powers. Which one did Empire Falls?
That is, I believe neither, but it's Richard.
And who is the 1950s actor? It's Richard Burton. But that's not Richard Powers.
I mean, we both have the internet here, so.
Who wrote the Florida, okay, well.
Empire Falls?
Richard Ford, Richard Powers.
Richard Russo, Richard Powers, and Richard Ford walking into a bar.
Bar is Richard Burton.
Anyway, so I like The Overstory. I read it and really enjoyed it. It's it was described in a way where it's like, oh, the trees are talking. And I thought it was going to be like weird and kind of hard to follow and just kind of like, oh, this is really dense. But it wasn't like that.
Towers, like the Ents.
Kind sort of. He's a very ecologically minded writer. He cares a lot about Mother Nature, Earth, science, and all those things are in the new novel. The basic plot of Bewilderment is a recently widowed husband and his son are trying to come to terms with the death of the kind of, you know, the mother or the wife in this case. And it's sort of a father-son story at the beginning. And it goes from there into a lot of science, a lot of political stuff. And my issues at the end of the day were it's very basic. And it almost felt like the book was saying, like, oh, you agree with these basic things, then you must like the book. Like,
a cookie cutter morality, and then
yeah, hey, very
feel like a good person.
Very, yeah, a lot of it's weird because the character, the young boy who's like 10, he has what you could consider like he might be on the spectrum of some things, and so it's like the school system is bad because they want to provide him, like give him, like, you know, pharmaceutical drugs. So sure. That's a very basic, oh, they're bad. And then they do some like silly things, in my opinion, that were just kind of like neurofeedback. So basically, like, his wife's brain, I don't think I'm spoiling too much, has been saved in this like neurofeedback therapy type thing. And then the son uses that to heal himself. But parts that were really off-putting and annoying were like the, oh my gosh, the earth is just dying, and our political system. And it is very much like a souped up Trump version, which is kind of hard to do, but it was like the Trump America to the extreme type thing. And it was very just like, it was almost like politics for dummies.
Not handled well.
It's just like heavy-handed, everything. It's just like, am I an idiot? Am I just supposed to like the book because I generally agree with all the politics in the book?
Yeah.
It just left a sour taste in my mouth. Like, oh, I'm supposed to like this because the most basic level of like human decency is like, I don't know. Yeah.
You clapping yourself on the back for whole.
Yeah, it's almost like going to see a comedian who says like the most obvious thing, and then everyone's like, "Yeah, that's good," and it's not really a joke, but they're like, "Yeah, we all agree." It felt like a groupthink type thing, like an echo chamber, like a little bit like my readers probably follow my politics. Let me give them something where they can all be like, "Yeah, you know, that's good point," and it left a lot of. The writing, I think, is okay. It's good, really good in parts. I think he's a really good writer, but it just felt very heavy-handed. Emotionally, at the end, it was undeserved, and it was just reaching for like these emotional points. And I don't know. It actually kind of made me very upset and angry. That I was like, oh man.
Yeah.
It upset me in ways that Sally Rooney didn't, because I had no previous experience with Sally Rooney, so I was coming into her fresh, and I didn't like most of the stuff she did, but I was at any point like really angry. But with Bewilderment, I was like, really, this is what we're saying is like serious, in-depth, you know, character. It just, I don't know, didn't.
I'm curious if we'll have to brace ourselves for stuff like this as the authors who are considered serious.
Yeah.
Feel like going forward to be taken seriously, they'll have to get political, but they weren't really, they have kind of your basic cookie cutter views on politics. And unless they really buckle down and do some real work and research, it might just kind of remain.
I mean, there's just scenes where like the kid is protesting outside like the Capitol or whatever, and he's got a sign about like saving the earth, and there's like a conflict, and it's just like, I kind of found the kid annoying, which I felt bad about. A kid who just lost his mother, who like, you know, is trying to save the earth, and I'm finding him annoying. I think.
What does he know about life?
kind of had that feeling.
Kind of bracing when a little 10-year-old tells you how the world should be. It's like, you know, you have no idea.
Yeah. And then the dad, and I don't know, just it left me kind of angry, to be honest with it. There were parts I thought in the beginning, I think in the core of the book, there is a not the most original storyline, but there are elements that I think if it was distilled to, like, I, for some reason, I like these scenes, like the father is a, I don't even know what the right term, he kind of comes up with scenarios where, like, life forms in, like, space on different planets could exist, and what those planets and how life would exist on those planets. And there's, like, what?
Science fiction guy?
No, he's you know, how they come up with, like, exoplanets. Like, they find planets in solar systems, and they go, you know, they determine how could life be there and how would it look, sort of things. And there are, like, these little two-page kind of pseudo chapters where he explains it to his son as sort of like a bonding thing. And if it was more of that and less of, like, oh, here's how we, you know, he just, no, it's,
he's a space nerd.
Yeah, he's a space nerd. But of course, the government, the unnamed government, cuts all the funding to the program at the very end.
Gotcha.
To all space stuff. It just felt like this is, I don't know. It just felt kind of, this seemed really easy to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I guess I don't know if I really have enjoyed a current political contemporary fiction where, like, the politics is thrown in there, or side of politics.
I wonder if they're not equipped for it. You know, I don't think it's impossible, but yeah, I wonder if, like, literary people who were previously apolitical aren't quite equipped to, and I don't mean equipped in, like, expertise. You don't have to be a political science major. It's not a credential. It's a matter of holding, being able to articulate and weave into your story a deeper meaning, a deeper understanding of politics and why people act the way they act politically in a society versus, hey, you know, why are bad things happening? Why are bad people doing bad? You know, that was my problem with, we have to keep bringing this up, but it kind of stands in as a bad, bad contemporary novelist, Topeka Schools thing.
Yeah.
He tried to explain the state of the world, and it was just kind of like you were saying with this. It's like, oh, this is not an explanation at all. This is,
well, it's almost like, here are the, you know, here are the issues with the world and blah blah blah. But it hasn't. It, I don't like when a book's fail to take care of, like, the smaller details of a person's life, and it's just like, oh, you know. So-and-so group of people want to cut all science funding, and that's, and everything else is just sort of underdeveloped. And as a story, it's just sort of, well, is this a story, or is this just, like, the, you know, are these certain characters holding the political signs at the street rally? And,
it's
you know, it's nothing's, like, all that original. And it's like, I agree with it, but I don't know. It just, it leaves me, I guess I will kind of be avoiding anything that's, like, overtly, like, and like I said, like, I agree with most of the politics in the book, but I just found it very annoying.
Politics doesn't necessarily make good literature.
I saw a review that said that, like, where you're just talking about politics, and then also, like, very, like, the earth is dying sort of, like, okay. And then a lot of that in row, and it's like, okay, I don't know the end game of what I'm supposed to take from this.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I go, yeah, I agree. And then, you know, what's the story there? But
yeah, what's the point of your novel?
So it was pretty negative. I posted it on Instagram, and I felt kind of bad because we're usually two lovable guys to talk about, hypothetically speaking, dog poop in bushes. But, you know, I usually go in. I'm usually not that harsh of a critic. I know this is back-to-back two books.
You also got to be honest.
Yeah, I do.
And you say you like everything when you don't.
Coming up, currently right now I'm reading Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr, who wrote All the Light We Can't See. I'm 2/3 of the way done with that one, and I am enjoying it a lot. It's very good. So if you're worried that I'm just Peter's going to be all negative, I do have, I'm also reading a history book called 12 Caesars by Mary Beard. I think I mentioned this earlier before. It is fantastic.
Nice.
So that is not fiction, but that's also, that's a new book that's just been released. And I'm not, you know, I've discussed this on the podcast before. I'm not like a Roman head. I don't, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs of the history and all that stuff. But I did enjoy I, Claudius when we read that. And this is really good. I'm just starting it. I'm only about, I don't know, a quarter of the way through it. But so there are some, I feel like there's going to be some positive reviews coming up. So.
Well, that's really.
And then I'm trying to, I don't know if I'll get to them, but Jonathan Franzen and Amor Towles' new books are also checked out from the library. So those might be on the docket for upcoming.
You got a lot of time.
Not really. Like I said, I checked those out. Those are both about 600 pages. So I'm not going to guarantee those.
Okay.
So with that said, let's transition into books I'm forced to read because Matt will kick me off the podcast if I don't read these. And that is going to be our seasonal fall, winter, spring, whatever season you want.
This will be fall.
Fall, okay.
Autumn.
It's similar to our monthly thing, only the book is probably longer and more in depth. Maybe sometimes there will be a movie that we will watch with it. And it's the same thing, three nominations from each of us. We discuss them and then we pick one of the nominations to read. And hopefully you, the listener, will read along with it. And then when the time comes in a couple months, we will discuss the book in depth. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. So I was Lonesome Dove yours or mine?
Both.
Both. We did both. So
it wasn't a... Peter insists on treating these as a contest.
Not a contest, but I do consider it a contest.
It's, yeah.
I'll start.
Okay. Well, let me just say I have four again.
Why do you do this?
Let's give a mess of cookie thing. You've let me do it in the past, and so now it's But you go.
Okay. This isn't the one that I have two that I don't think we're going to pick, but this one I think has a good chance of being picked.
Okay.
You have nominated this author before. It is an author. It's kind of daunting for me. He is someone, I don't know, like in college and then, yeah, mostly in college, people who would read him, I felt were cooler than me and were smarter than me and could understand references more and text than me. And I felt it kind of felt like the indie band that I didn't really understand. And they like, oh, they got the references and they got all the stuff. And I don't know. I was scared of them. I'm scared of them.
Lester Wallace?
Nope. Still writing. Still
alive.
Still, I think he's still alive. Let me
double check.
Still alive. Like I said, you nominated one of his books. This is his, I would, most well-known book. I don't know if it's the book you like start with this author, but it's the book I'm nominating, and it's Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, the 1974 book, I want to say. Yeah, 74, 73. Hold on here. The prizes kind of get confusing. 1973. What did you nominate? Not as a seasonal, but you did something else with Thomas Pynchon, didn't you?
Oh, Inherent Vice.
Inherent Vice.
So Thomas Pynchon is one of my more embarrassing gaps.
I don't even know if it's gap because he seems to have this reputation of like, oh, it's you almost hear the question, like, what do I need to do to prepare to read Thomas Pynchon?
Well, and just so off-putting. Here's my thoughts on that, because I think this would be a good time to do Pynchon.
Okay.
I read Crying Aloud 49 in college, and that's the extent of my Pynchon.
I have no Pynchon.
But, so, and I thought if I started with Pynchon, I wouldn't start with Gravity's Rainbow. I'd start with Against the Day, or Inherent Vice, or V, or Vineland, or something.
Yeah.
But a lot of the book Twitter circles that I kind of run in, that our account runs in, they're very big on Pynchon. Mm-hmm. They've clearly read almost all of Pynchon, and I kind of just duck out of those conversations. Like, hey, look at my cool Pynchon cover, and I just don't say I haven't read it. It's just a cool cover.
I don't think we should be embarrassed to not. I mean, maybe we have. No. Should we be embarrassed? I don't know.
Just around the cool kids. You're right about it being a cool kid author.
Doesn't it feel like a cool kid's book?
And I think it's telling neither of us have really read them. We're not the cool kids.
We're not. So, yeah, I've always felt like...
God, that's a difficult one to jump in on.
I know. It's tough. It's a tough one.
Infinite Jest. I think it was a heavy influence on Infinite Jest. It's kind of tempting.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't even know what it's really...
throwing you into the deep end.
Yeah, it's... I think...
nuclear physicist, there's a rocket scientist...
There's
all sorts of layers. Pynchon would be fun to do. We really should one of these.
We could drown. We could drown just by like.
That's the fear.
My kind of only worry is we would do it and we would sound like complete morons discussing the book.
It's way over our heads. I'm pretty sure there's some nuclear physicists or rocket scientists.
There's rockets. There's V2 rockets. There's.
There's all sorts of cool conspiratorial stuff hidden in Pynchon's work. There's probably stuff, but you're right. I would be worried about
metaphysics, science, profanity, low culture, high culture.
Well, you like the profanity.
Of course I do. Yeah, I just think, you know, it's a difficult book. I grant you that.
Very difficult.
But I think what I would say is it's something maybe that if we did it by ourselves, we would suffer alone. Maybe it's not as hard as people say, you know, maybe we would be like, okay, maybe it's one of those books where you don't have to like, understand every single reference to get something out of it, which I think is the case with most books of that kind of difficulty. Yeah. But if we read it together, we could do a podcast together.
That would be, we would do an episode on it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the whole point. I'm explaining the purpose of the show to you. But yeah, that's my first nomination. Gravity's Rainbow.
That's okay. That's it's tempting.
My two other ones, you're not going to.
No. Well, we'll see. Okay.
I will say this, out of my three nominations, it is not the most difficult one to read.
Oh goodness.
Okay. The stage is set. Matt,
what did you start off with?
Give me your
first. I'll start with this one. Okay. This is, I think you might have nominated it as a monthly a while back. It's it seems very autumnal, very autumny. It is a good time to maybe revisit it. And it's about 650 pages. So it's, you know.
Good. That's good. That's a length.
Written in 1859. It's one of the earlier examples of the detective in American fiction. It's considered the author's best work by the author himself. It's The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins.
The Woman in White.
It's like a proto detective thriller fiction from 1859. Wilkie Collins, a reviewer said it's by far his best book. Wilkie Collins agreed. In fact, it says on his tombstone, the author of The Woman in White and other fiction. So he was clearly the most proud of this one. Looks cool. My little paper rack copy's got a cool cover of a house in the drizzling rain. It looks I don't know. It's good. A good autumn novel. It'd be fun.
Yeah. It looks like the BBC's listed as number 77 on it's like
yeah.
something.
And it's on somebody else's when I was reading about it. It's in the 20s and somebody else's.
It's a very famous book. Yeah. I got here the I think the main character's name is Walter Hatwright.
Yeah.
I don't know what to feel about that. That's a solid name. It's a solid name.
Walter Hatwright.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Let's see if there's been any movies. I'm sure there have. Yeah, there's been quite a few. Most recently, it was adapted in 2018 by the BBC for a TV series.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There you go.
Yeah.
It was made into, in 1982, a Soviet film. There you go. How about that?
Thing we could do both. We could do the Soviet and the American
version. I like it. The Woman in White, Detective, old book, classic. It's a classic.
Yeah.
I don't know if they still teach it. I don't think I ever was.
Like, no, but that doesn't mean one thing.
Come on now. It does. It means something.
We've read enough books to where there's tons of stuff that they don't teach in school. And sometimes they ruin the stuff they do teach in schools. It'd be more popular if it was not taught in schools.
Okay, so we got Pynchon, we got Collins. They're at the dinner table. Who else is invited? Let me go. This is my next nomination. Is based on, I believe, a true story. Now, the exact kind of, it's basically a murder crime fiction story. Mm-hmm. And it's based on a murder from 1906. It's the murder of Grace Brown, and it's the trial of her lover. And the author started kind of a fictionalized account, or based kind of this book based on that famous murder, like a decade later. He started the book in 1920. He abandoned it and then came back to it and finished it in 1925. I've read another of this author's work and quite liked it quite a bit, and read it in college. In 2005, the book was placed on Time Magazine's list of top 100 novels written in English since 1923. It's a very strange distinction, but it works, I guess. The book was banned in 1927 in Boston due to sexual content, abortion, and murder. Not to be outdone by Boston, the Nazis banned it because it deals with low love affairs. So there you go. It's a little silly history of the book. The book I am talking about is called An American Tragedy by Theodore Dreiser. I read Sister Carrie in college and quite liked it. And like it says, it is a crime fiction book, kind of the downfall of our main character, whose name is Clyde Griffiths. And I believe the last part of the book is the trial of his. It's a pretty big book. The copy, I have a mass market copy. It comes in at 828 pages.
Oh, wow.
It's, So a little crime fiction is my selling point for this one. Some early crime fiction by a classic American author.
I have a copy of that.
You do?
Yeah.
Have you read it?
I didn't know it was a crime fiction. I thought it was serious, depressing. I got it at a used bookstore. I was like, I should probably eventually read this. So.
Yeah, it's there were actually, the plot of this book has influenced a lot of other books and sort of movies and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a crime murder book. So, but yeah, I always thought it was sort of middle class Pennsylvania novel or something.
Yeah, me too. I don't know why that's the impression. That's just the reputation or what I thought Dreiser was.
Yeah.
Interesting though.
There you go. There's my second nomination.
That's a good, solid nomination.
Solid choice. I don't feel it has the juice to win, but It's a cool cover. It's a cool book. I'm interested because I have to say, Sister Carrie was fantastic. Good writing. Yeah. Really, really good writing from what I remember. This would have been 15, 20 years ago. So that's my second nomination.
Good. That's a solid one, too. You got to sell these better.
Yeah, maybe. You're up next.
All right. This one's also come up before, so we'll see what happens. Yeah. Hey, did you know it is illegal to pump your own gas in Oregon?
I do know that.
Yeah, very, very weird. Do you know what I am?
I think I know what you're going
to
say. But
I was up in Oregon like a month ago. The family went to Oregon, and I found that out. I was like, you're kidding, right? And I'm like, no, watch. And I pulled up, and the guy came up and just does all the stuff we're used to doing, and it's very weird. And then we were driving along the road. I was like, you know what? They filmed a movie here with Paul Newman, and I wonder, you know, where is, so I was like, where's Newport? And the people we were with were like, what? Because I mumble a lot and they don't understand me. Like, where's Newport? And they're like, Newport, what? I can't. And then I had to speak up. They're like, oh, Newport, yeah, it's down the road. And so it's, but it reminded me of the house that's in both the book and the movie. Takes place in Oregon in the early 60s.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Sometimes a Great Notion.
Yep.
There we go. By Ken Kesey.
Yep. Man. And I've wanted to read that for a while. Being up there kind of like rekindled my, I'm like, you know what? I'm gonna get my copy out. See what.
I have the same feeling. Obviously, I've read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that's obviously his most famous novel. But this one, just from the description and just sort of the epic nature of it, I was drawn to a few years ago, bought a copy, and I have not gotten to it. I believe I nominated it before.
Yeah, you did.
And this is why you win this game so often.
I don't know why we didn't. I don't know what we picked instead, but it was close because I've wanted to read it too. Charles Bowden, the famous journalist, called it one of the only essential books written by an American of the last half century.
Well, that's kind of ridiculous, but
no, I mean, I don't know. It's supposed to be good and solid. It's up in Oregon. There's a family of loggers, and the local logging mill goes on strike, and this family kind of decides to be scabs. Yeah. You know, they continue, you know, logging and selling to the suppliers, even though, you know, so the town's furious at him, and there's all sorts of family dynamic. There's a stern patriarch, and then the kid too. Yeah, it just sounds really epic, pretty good. Oregon's a cool place. I am before Ken Kesey.
No, yeah, I'd be surprised if that doesn't win, I'll be honest. That's a really good.
It's also one of the, it would be our second book that has its title is kind of half a phrase. We have If on a Winter's Night's a Traveler.
Yeah, it's true.
And then Sometimes a Great Notion. It seems like there's more to that. Sometimes a Great Notion, what?
Yeah.
Goes awry? Falls flat? Like, what's the, it's a title that leaves you going, and?
And?
And what? Sometimes a Great, you know. Yeah. So that's a selling point. Probably wind up doing that, huh? Let's see what your third one is.
My third one is let's take the boat back to Europe. Let's go to Europe. This author, when you're talking about, and this isn't my saying, but this is like some blurry criticism. When you're talking about the big writers of the 20th century in Europe, this author is often, he's the least widely read. And I think without knowing too much about that, I think that's kind of obviously the case. So if you're thinking of, I think it was said of all the Europe's novelists, was this quote? It's from Michael Hoffman of the New York Times. So this, thinking about Proust, Joyce, Kafka, Mann, and Wolfe, Robert Musil is far and away the least read. And the book I'm talking about, and I'm only talking about the first volume of the book, because the entire I believe you can get it in two volumes, and I'm not entirely sure about the third volume, but it's 1,700 pages. I'm not asking us to read that. I'm only asking us to read the first volume of the book. It's called The Man Without Qualities. It takes place in 1913. It's an Austrian book in Vienna, and it's the our main character is Franz, Ulrich. He's an ex-soldier. He's a scientist, seducer, skeptic. It's a novel of ideas. It's what I gather. It's a little bit of, the plot. It's not the main point of the book. Maybe a little philosophy, a little satire, a thinking man's book, maybe.
I like ideas.
You do like ideas. I have just the first volume. Man Without Qualities. I'm showing the cover to you right now.
Half of a guy's face.
Half of a guy's face. It's 720 pages. It's one of those books that I definitely want to read. It's daunting. A little bit like The Pynchon. Maybe I won't understand half of it. Thomas Mann said, "The Man Without Qualities is without doubt the greatest writing, ranking with the finest of our epics epoch has to offer." It's praised by a lot of serious people, serious literature people that are, I don't think this is a book you pick up just for like a Sunday afternoon read. I think you kind of delve into it head first or not at all. So, Man Without Qualities. This was a new translation from 1996, I want to believe, that I think the translators won some awards for, like, it's a very good translation. It is the Sophie Wilkins and Burton Pike translation is what I'm holding up. So I know we're not going to pick this book, but hey, if you want to go, you want to go crazy and we read a...
Of your three, I've kind of heard of that.
Let me read, let's see here. The New Yorker said, "A colossus contains pages of the highest interest and the highest art." How about that? The Boston Sunday Globe said of this translation, "This English translation is an important cultural event, a monumental achievement." About that, I don't think this book was actually ever finished, too, from what I believe. I believe Musil died while writing this book, but
I guess one quality he I
close enough, I think.
Hold on. I guess one quality he didn't have finishing things.
That's a good, there we go. That's a good, it first appeared in Completion, Germany in 1978. So there's that. So I think it appeared before parts of it, but not the whole thing. A Man Without Qualities. The Man Without Qualities. Volume one.
Of yours, I like that the best.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I appreciate that, buddy. It's also, just to let you know, if we did go to pick this, the print is pretty small and it covers the entire page. So I take this book. What?
No, it's a big old book.
It's a big old flop. This edition's great. It has, I'll just read this on my own. Probably, I would like some help with it. It's, some company on the journey, if you will. So that's my last nomination. Matt, you have two more nominations.
Two more.
Let's do both of them. Let's do both.
Yeah, we'll talk about them. All right, this next one. So have you ever wanted to maybe go for a run?
Rarely.
Like tomorrow, no, you're like, I'm going to get in shape. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 5 and I'm going to go for a run.
Yeah.
You usually don't do it, but it's in your head. It's like, this would be good to do. I just want to make myself do it. This would be kind of like that. I know it's not the most fun one that we have here. But it's history. It would be good to have read. I think it opened up a lot of doors to some other fiction and other works, like classical works, and make us be better able to understand them. If you got this under our belts. So it'd be, I don't think we'll pick it, but maybe we should, okay. You know, I like have a brisk morning run.
Yeah.
There's Thucydides, the history of the Peloponnesian War.
No, it's just not even an option. I write down, just to the listener, I write down this. I didn't even, you're going to have to spell that for me so I can write this down.
History of the Peloponnesian War. Oh,
can you spell the author's name?
Thucydides. It's in Greek. Thucydides. Thucydides.
History of the Paul. Okay.
That sounds like a question and answer. Thucydides?
If you're a funny guy.
So yeah, he was a Athenian, okay. A general for the Athenians, and he kept a really detailed account of the Peloponnesian War, the war between Athens and Sparta. I think back in the, I believe it was 400 BC-ish. But yeah, it's considered one of the first serious historical works in Western literature. Herodotus was before, but Herodotus was kind of, I guess you'd call him a fabulist a bit. He talks about giants,
okay.
Logical things like their facts, and exaggerates the numbers and the armies and stuff. Thucydides gives credit for being kind of a serious historian who verifies his facts and everything. And the fact that he was a general gives it some extra weight. It's considered one of the, him and then Julius Caesar's commentaries are considered some of the best historical writings on warfare.
Okay. Actually, and the more I kind of dismissed it, but
yeah, if, like I say, it'd be good. I don't even think it'd be boring. I think you just have to dive in and just really, we know a lot about the Peloponnesian War. We decided to do it. If you can actually get up and go running at 5 a.m.
How long is it?
My little paperback copy is about 600. Yeah, 620
pages. That counts as a seasonal.
Not too long. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's within, big enough to be a seasonal, 620.
You get a cool Penguin edition.
Yeah, that's what I got, Penguin Classics. Be the first nonfiction we did. I had about 8 books I was going to do, and I came close. Yesterday, I was thinking to myself, I'm going to nominate 8 books and just see what happens. And a lot of them were history. I'm like, let's just try to steer this towards doing a history. And then I thought, I reined it in.
I'm actually curious about this book. I'm going to put it actually on my, like, my radar. I'm going to mark it down as, like,
pick it up.
You should read this, like, as a running... And I would kind of bet that I would enjoy it a lot more than I would think I would.
Oh, me too. The assumption behind what you just said is that we're not going to pick it. Like, you've already picked it. But
we could pick it.
It would be fun. Well, we should keep it in the, we haven't voted yet.
I'm looking at some of the reviews just by, you know, your average Joes and Janes on Amazon, and people say it's fantastic. Like, high praise.
It'd be good because I've talked about this. There's a lot of stuff like fiction that I want to read that takes place in ancient Greece. I don't know too much about it, so it'd be good, I think, to lay the groundwork to understand more of that stuff, to actually know, because I know vaguely that Athens and Sparta fought wars, you know, but I don't know too much about the details. And be good. That's what I'm saying. It's like a run. It's like a brisk. It's like we force ourselves to do something a little more difficult.
Yeah, it's, yeah. I mean, I think it would be the surprise of the podcast era that we picked this.
Where we keep in mind, we can have one of these times doing also ran.
Yeah.
We do cities and.
Well, okay. The history of the Peloponnesian War. Is your third nomination, and you had one more.
One more. Okay. And this would be fun to get around to at some point. If the Thucydides is a brisk run in the morning that you don't want to do, this would be like a staying in bed and just watching an old classic movie.
Okay. I don't know what that, I don't know.
Like a comforting movie, like a Wes Anderson's film or something.
There's a new movie coming out. So it's...
Yeah. But anyways, it wouldn't be difficult. It'd be fun. It's a subject that I think we should touch on at some point. It is, I don't know, have you heard of it? It's called A Gentle Madness by Nicholas Bass Baines.
Not heard of this.
Nonfiction, and the subtitle is called Bibliophiles, Bibliomanes, and the Eternal Passion for Books.
Ooh, I like this.
The History of Bibliophilia, basically. It starts off with the Library of Alexandria, you know, and whenever BC, 2,200 years ago, and the attempt, that was an attempt to collect all the world's knowledge. And it kind of goes through, the first half is kind of going through the history of libraries and all that. And then the second half is a study of more recent eccentric book collector types, you know, bibliophiles, people with large libraries.
Very interesting.
Yeah. In the, on the jacket, it talks about, well, the passion to possess books has never been more widespread than it is today. The book is richly anecdotal and fully documented. It combines the perspective of historical research with the immediacy of investigative journalism. Points out that bibliomania is the only hobby to have it be officially classified as a disease.
Really?
Yeah. So. So it's a good book. It's got a really cool cover. Some of the, there's picture, you know, how certain nonfiction books have those little breaks where there's 10 pages of,
yeah, photo.
There's a couple of those. It's pretty cool. It'd be a good, it'd be very fitting for us as a podcast to do. You know, it's a lot of pictures of cool libraries, a lot of, yeah.
I think we have, once again, some great nominations here.
I think even yours. I think all seven.
Even mine. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah, even the ones that I at first was like, no, I kind of sort of like the idea of doing. I would say the one I'm least interested in would be The Woman in White. I'm still interested, but compared to the others, I'm not going to like go to bat for that one. Do you agree or no?
Oh, sure. That's fine. I would like to do that, but there's other stuff. So I'm not going to.
Out of mine, what's your, what's realistic and what's kind of where you're.
And don't take this as a criticism of you. I'm just, in my head, I've always had like, okay, here's how I'm going to do Pynchon eventually. Had you chosen Mason Dixon or V
or
something, I think I'd want to do that over everything else. Be like,
I thought Mason Dixon. I was going to do Mason Dixon, and I thought, you know what? Let's do the big one first.
I just don't know that I want to start with Gravity's Rainbow. That might be illogical of me or irrational. Sure. But of yours, The Man Without Qualities would be the brisk morning run thing.
Oh, it's,
let's just do it. I think it'd be good in the long run. Doesn't seem as fun as some of the others, but you know what? That would be of yours what I'd advocate for.
Okay. I mean, it's, yeah. It's like the run. It would be good for us to tackle it, but out of yours, sometimes a great notion is a book that I'm very much drawn to.
Yeah. Is this economy?
What's that?
Like a good fall read.
Family drama of.
Yeah. An epic.
Magnum opus.
Yeah.
Weirdly, you don't really hear about it too often.
I think the Cuckoo's Nest and then the Tom Wolfe book kind of overshadow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's from all accounts, important work. I kind of want to do the Kinkizi. I don't know.
I'm tempted.
The History of Peloponnesian War, the more I think about it, actually would be another good choice. I might ask a lot of dumb questions when we talk about that book. That's my kind of worry about, like, are these real?
I don't worry about that too much.
A Gentle Madness just sounds like a book I would be interested in. I don't know if it, I'm glad you brought it up because now I know about it and I can mark it as a book to be on the lookout for.
On your radar too. And next time we hang out, I'll show you my copy. It's pretty cool.
And then American Tragedy, to be honest, I don't know if that has enough appeal to beat out some of our other nominations.
Yeah.
So where my vote is for Sometimes a Great Notion.
Yeah, fine. Let's do it. I don't want to read it as much as that or Thucydides. And I was like, it's like, oh, I could probably talk us into Thucydides.
You got closer. I would say that's my second choice.
I could, but honestly, I'm staring at Sometimes a Great Notion now. I think I want to, let's just do that.
Do it? Okay.
Good fall read. The house is so cool. I mean, I know there's no pictures of the actual house, but the house where they used for the movie.
Yeah.
And it's this as the river in the story, a bunch of houses were built on the river. And I get it takes place in the 60s. And so, you know, the river's expanded and most people have abandoned their houses and moved further up the slopes of the river, you know, but the Stamper family, they're stubborn and they've stayed. And so their house is almost over the water.
I've read the first like 5 pages.
Google the Sometimes a Great Notion house. It looks pretty cool.
Okay.
There's a Paul Newman movie we can watch after we're done. I think it's.
I like it.
Cool. Good.
So add that to the TBR. That's our autumn seasonal book read. So once again, that we're going to read this book over a couple months and then do an episode or two. We always leave that option open. We are also reading quite a few other things. So I don't know if you noticed, we also added The Red and the Black by Stendhal, which was a little seasonal, but I'm not sure. That's still on the TBR, but that's sort of its own category.
I started it.
Okay, so that's still there. We're reading The House of Mirth, which I think we're planning on recording next week, by Edith Wharton. That was our previous monthly read. Currently, we have one big book and one small book. The first one we'll do is The Turn of the Screw, right? By Henry James.
The novella, short story.
The short story novella.
I'm almost done with it. I like it. There's a lot to delve into, okay. But we haven't started.
So. That's kind of spooky because we like to do spooky stuff in October. Yeah. Is it spooky? I haven't started it yet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't want to say too much. It's good.
And then we also have,
Little Stranger.
Little Stranger. Also, Sarah Waters.
Very good.
Which I've started. So those are sort of our books. We have a lot of books. And then also, you know, I hopefully will be able to continue my contemporary fiction reviews on this podcast and see if I can find a book I like and recommend it to you. But Matt, you were saying earlier you had something else for me.
So here's because we've been doing the Patreon episodes, and we're doing the next one we record will probably be one of our Patreon football episodes.
Yes,
kind of a quarter into the season, we'll make bets, go over the Broncos Super Bowl odds.
I think I owe you a book.
Yeah, well, we'll get into it, but there's some other. I've been reading some old Gore Vidal essays, and it struck me like I want you to read them. And not even as a punishment, because they actually touch on a lot of stuff we talk about. The nature of fiction, what good criticism should be, all this stuff. Yeah. And I offered to switch out. I was like, can you read one or two of these essays? You don't have to buy me a book. And Peter's insisting on them, which is very nice. It's good. But
I'm a man of honor. There you go.
Make some wagers that involve, you know, some loser has to just read something.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's beside my point is the show Ombudsman, Thaddeus.
Thaddeus.
Asked, because we mentioned if you have any suggestions for a seasonal read, let us know. And he was asking where he could do that. And I was like, oh, what do you have in mind? And he's like, well, as long as you're doing the Patreon or the, you know, the football Patreon stuff, you should maybe do a football book. And he was going to suggest something like John Feinstein wrote a book called Next Man Up,
Oh, yes.
Behind the Scenes of the Baltimore Ravens. I've actually read that, and it's pretty good. It's just, you know, like he was a fly on the wall for a year and just observed how that whole organization operated. And I was like, you know, like that would be that's a good suggestion. If I nominated it, I couldn't guarantee it would actually get chosen.
Yeah.
But I was thinking what we could do, because we are doing football episodes through February.
Yeah.
And if you're down, I have a list of maybe 5 or 6 football books that are good to do. And you kind of marinate on it. I'll ask Vlad and some other patrons if they have suggestions. And so on the next Patreon episode, we'll go over and list maybe 6 or 7-ish football books. And then we'll vote. But everybody, you and I will get one vote. And each of our patrons you'll get an equal vote.
I like it.
And that's how we'll...
We would like to do that in the future, is to have the Patreons have a say and kind of direct our reading,
like what we did just now,
that we, you know, wouldn't necessarily pick. So
only it's you guys, and patrons get an extra, you know, an actual vote, an equal vote. So I'm thinking that's what we'll do. I'll show my list, we'll talk about them, we'll go over and kind of describe each one on the next episode, and then we'll vote, and then we'll have a football book. The episode, we'll talk about it, and we'll do a full episode on it on Patreon.
I like it.
That's what we'll do.
I like it. So that, yeah, if you didn't know, we do have a Patreon account where we put up episodes just for our Patreons. And so, any support there, greatly appreciated. We like to kind of build up this fun little bookish, nerdish community of people like books, but also like sports or whatever. Whatever you like. We don't care. We also have a cool Instagram and Twitter account, and an email account, and we always like it when people hit us up with what they're reading or what their thoughts are. If you read Sometimes a Great Notion, let us know your thoughts. If you haven't, join us. I think people have read, you know, quite a few people have read, you know, his other works, but not necessarily this one, maybe just because of its length, and it's kind of maybe a little daunting, but curious to see. Anything else, Matt?
That's about it. Look out for these new episodes. We're gonna get all these books, we get done.
We read.
We have yet to decide on a book we're officially reading and to not actually read it.
we just push it off. The House of Mirth. There's a lot to talk about. And if you think, oh, that's just a stuffy high society book, there's a lot to unpack. And I think just to hint at the episode, I think it kind of resembles a little bit like current society in certain ways about how people seek out wealth and
society. That would be fun to talk about. Another one, like having read her now, it's like, whoa, how did I miss this? She's very
exactly. Yeah,
she's one of those like, okay, I need to read everything she's written. She's like that.
So, be on the lookout for that. And as always, thanks for listening, supporting us. Talk to you soon.
Bye.